You know, one of the most helpful things you can know is that embodied in that saying, only volition is the doer of karma, only feeling is the reaper of karma. And it's such a simple little, you know, to put it in such an exquisitely simple form masks the profundity of it. You know, to really penetrate that teaching, included in that is the truth of no self. There's no better actual practical description of no self. Only volition is the doer of karma. Only feeling is the reaper of karma. There's no self behind that is doing the acting and reaping the consequences. And contained within the teaching of no self is actually, although many people never seem to realize it, the teaching of the greater self. Which you have to come to through the immaculacy of nothingness. Well, through really two things. One of them is love and gratitude, and the other is the experience of the immaculacy of nothingness, which come together and are really the same thing, but for a long time may not be realized to be the same thing. Because that no-thingness, that no-selfness that lies behind only volition is the doer of karma, only feeling is the reaper of karma, that implies, whether one knows it or not, the truth of the true self, the reality of the true self. Now, that's not really the subject of this talk. Feeling is the subject of this talk, in part, but with a particular emphasis. And it's really to show that emphasis, I have to make a distinction. There's the feeling which is the reaper of karma that is such and such was done some time back, and at some point the particular karma comes due, and when that comes due, in its final form, there's the experience of pure states of feeling. Okay, so this works for both what we call, and let's call it loosely, both good and bad karma. So the when you're tootling along and all of a sudden you notice, oh, geez, today I feel very peaceful and kind of quietly happy. Just to use one particular kind of state of feeling. That's reaping some merit sown in the past, whether in the near past or the distant past, you know, who knows, but it's reaping. There's a reason for that. If one is walking around feeling fairly normal, all of a sudden it feels like you dropped into a pit of despondency or despair or misery of some kind or other, well, that also is karma being reaped. And again, whether it's the near past or the distant past or both, well, we won't worry about that at the moment. Those states of feeling are relatively simple in the sense that they're just pure states of feeling that hit or are triggered by some event. The distinction that I want to make here is between those states of feeling and states of feeling that come about as a result of being swept up in external things and agitated. The result of, it's a good term, spiritual agitation, really. Term spiritually agitated, So that one gets into a state that that can just best be described as emotionalism. Emotionalism. Where one is actually actively whipping up the feelings by what one is doing. And one has a kind of a crescendo building of willful impulsiveness and emotional agitation, excitement, and, you know, the passions. And, you know, we've all experienced this in any number of ways. There's many ways in which you can experience it. You can be, you know, sitting quietly in meditation and go down a particular track of thought. I mean, how many jillion times have I done this, and all of us, I suppose, start down a particular track of thought and start to actually experience the feelings getting whipped up, starting to get worried, starting to get afraid, starting to get inwardly agitated. And you can actually, you know, watch yourself do this. And then, you know, oops, you know, signals. The feelings are signals, aren't they? You know, one of their important functions is signals. Signal, red light, stop doing what you're doing with your thoughts there. Pull back, you see. And if it's easy to do that in formal meditation, think how much easier it is in the midst of the activity of daily life. I mean, it happens all the time, doesn't it? Sometimes often it's the result of a whole nexus of conditions acting upon us and our reaction to that, to the stresses of that. But in the end, if one goes down the road of putting it onto just the external circumstances, and makes that a kind of a, first it starts as in your mind as a reason, but then of course it becomes an excuse. I'm this way today because, you know, all these circumstances are like this. And there can be an element of having compassion for oneself in that. And then one has to be careful it doesn't slide into an excuse for perpetuating a particular way of suffering, a particular kind of suffering. And that's another thing. I don't think you don't have to, you know, give any experienced meditator a lecture in how you do this to yourself. Because, you know, we've all experienced it. You know, many, many times in many, many ways. I think, you know, you could, in general, you could say, you know, it's a good reason why we undertook meditation in the first place is to, you know, get out of those incredible tape loops we get into where we're kind of, you know, driving ourselves crazy and laying it on to other people in external circumstances. So the point that I want to emphasize today is that while you can't do anything about those situations in which you reap the past karma through the simple arising of particular states of feeling, once you're in those states of feeling, well, you just got to endure them and try not to do silly things under their influence. Try not to act impulsively under the influence of feeling. And that includes the more blissful feeling. So you can be a real ass when you're in bliss. You know, that's another one I've done many times. So, you know, and you can start drawing conclusions very quickly in your mind about what this means about you and about other people. You know, and don't go down that road if you can help it. Don't draw conclusions. Being happy doesn't make you right. That's another way to put it. Being happy is not proof that you're right. Anyway, I want to draw a distinction between those circumstances of just, experiencing feeling as a reaper of karma and doing the best one can to meditate with and cope with it, and the state where one gets into a kind of a cycle of generating an emotionalistic state and then sustaining it. And, if you want to think about how one of the absolute classics, you see this parodying in comedy a lot, and it's a good reason, because it's one of our strongest tendencies, is self-righteousness. Self-righteousness is one way in which we can do that. And when one's kind of justifying one's position in one's mind, and one's getting more and more, tanked up with the feeling of rightness, and one's on the one's more and more kind of head out on the war path, with the forces of darkness that are opposing one, and it's parodied, and the Pink Panther movies are full of this, particularly benign light, actually, but Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther movie, he plays a pompous fool, basically. He's a pompous fool, and that's the British poking fun at the French, of course. Which there's always this cross channel poking of fun at each other going on. I'm a great lover of Peter Sellers. And I think he's delightful when he's doing that, but it's also poking fun at something that we so easily do in our own minds, and just one of the ways in which we work ourselves up into a kind of an emotionalistic state, and of course there's many others, and. In kind of combination with serious meditation, and you might think, well, those are kind of antithetical, but they're not as antithetical as you'd think, because we're very complex beings, and we can combine seeming antithetical elements with the most amazing facility and ease. And there's another thing, I've tried all these things myself, I sometimes found myself, especially in my early years in training, I'd get in some kind of strange place in my spiritual life where I'd be both working at meditation and also working myself into an emotionalistic state. I'm wondering, how can you do both those at once? Was it? I don't really have any really easy explanation, actually, except that somehow I managed it. I presume other people can too. And that can often be when a person is actually trying too hard in meditation and gets a kind of a more kind of a, you might say, an unconsciously ascetic effort and starts kind of driving. And without knowing it, you kind of start to, initially you don't know it. Later on, maybe you become more aware of it, but you start to actually experience darker states of feeling that you're actually creating through a wrongfully directed effort in meditation. And that can go, if there's a really strong willful element in it, that can go very dark indeed, into deep despair and really, really miserable states and anger and stuff. And then someone's got to come in. If it really gets locked in, someone's got to come in and somehow drag you out of it. We had to do that with a person here, you know, some years back. And the person's still hopping mad. Never kind of... At the time, she actually realized that she'd really been saved from something awful. Later on, she kind of rewrote history. But this is what happened. And you know, especially until we really have trained enough, and there's been enough conversion of karma that we actually beginning to get the distinction between what is a willful act and what is willingness, and how that applies in the practice of meditation and in one's daily life, indeed in one's daily life. I guess that's always a risk. So these can be muddier waters than one would first think. And I'll just try to give a simple, you know, one or two simple little rules of thumb for how to be aware of when we're getting ourselves kind of worked up emotionally in a way that isn't really healthy. And basically, I'd say the more I train, the more I think that, well, getting yourself worked up and emotionally in any way isn't actually really healthy, frankly, spiritually healthy. That's not saying anything's wrong with the emotions. You know, it's just what we call emotions is just, you know, feelings, aren't they? Really, and you know, you can't make yourself an unfeeling being. That's not the point. But the kind of willful activity of the mind and or the speech and body, you know, that really becomes focused, whether consciously or unconsciously, on the kind of whipping up of a particular emotional state and sustaining it, that's dangerous. That's dangerous. You have to be careful with that. So the, you know, the first rule of thumb is really just is one losing the sense of one's spiritual center and starting to get too outside oneself. And I think that most people have to have actually done a certain amount of meditation training to actually to be able to make this distinction at all. But once you really start to seriously undertake meditating and training, especially after some years of it, you begin to recognize when you're too drawn outside yourself. And it that can begin with little things that aren't big emotional states. It can begin with curiosity. Curiosity can be really dangerous. It can begin with imagination. It can begin with an interest in what other people are up to. You know, it can begin with any number of seemingly innocent little impulses. Then one just really has to be careful where they lead and how far one goes down that particular path. Something can begin with a kind of idle curiosity and end up with an involvement in something really, really messy and really spiritually unhealthy. So the first little principle is, am I starting to get too much outside my center? Am I starting to spread myself? This is one of the things that Rin Master said in the early years at the Abbey, that's one of those little gems. She'd say, periodically, she'd say, don't spread yourself. I mean, you know, don't spread yourself too thin so that you're carried too much outside yourself. You're kind of out there doing this, that, and the other thing, and you're no longer staying in your center. You know, look for the things that actually need to be done and address them. Look for something that actually needs to be done. Nowadays, they use the term multitasking a lot. And it's often I've seen it like on television, like used in a context of if you can do this, you're like accomplishing more by doing it, and this is therefore kind of a automatically good thing. Well, I'm not saying it can't be a good thing, but you know, you really have to consider what is it you're accomplishing. You can be accomplishing getting yourself in a frenzy and doing really stupid things. You can be accomplishing doing a lot of things really poorly and without the right attitude, and nothing really thoroughly and really well and with the proper attitude. See what I'm saying? You can't define what is really good to do by externals. So be careful about spreading yourself. The next thing is obviously the precepts. You know, when one of the precepts starts lighting up, we're going to go down a road of anger. We're getting frustrated and getting more and more short-tempered. There's one. You know, we're getting greedy and caught up in some particular desire and getting more and more wrapped up in it. You know, and not any number of the precepts apply to that. We're getting judgmental, prideful, starting to find fault in everyone around us and in the world in general. There's another one. You know, the precepts are just vital to us. It's not accidental that Rin Master called them the lifeblood of the Buddhas. Because, you know, really our work is, spiritual work is to live the precepts, not just in their letter, but to, you know, live the true spirit of the precepts, which is something much deeper than any kind of literal understanding of the precepts. And so the third one, little rule of thumb that I would just mention, is just basically being excited. If you get excited, you need to calm down. And this is where, you know, the contemplative religion can differ a lot from worldly ideas. And another term that's used a lot nowadays, and they're like fads in language, which express kind of fads in thought. And a lot of our modern fads in language have to do with psychology, basically, and the application of certain psychological theories, especially at a popular level. And one of the terms you see most commonly used nowadays to attempt to describe what it is to live a meaningful life is to live a life where you live your passion. And we've all heard that. You live your passion. Well, that can have a benign meaning, and it can have a really screwball, confused meaning. And because the way the words use it almost never actually distinguishes between the two, I just want to encourage you, in general, don't live your passion. you know, if you want the more contemplative expression, is follow your true heart, follow your true nature, and you'll quickly, when you do that, you quickly find that it often doesn't align with whatever any particular passion is at the moment. You know, getting excited and wound up hardly ever helps. It may be that there's a time when it does, like the house is on fire, you get a big adrenaline rush and it helps you get the hell out of there and maybe rescue the canary on your way. You know, these things have their use. Everything has a proper use. But in general, getting excited, getting emotionally wrapped up in things isn't a big help. And tends to really cloud our vision. And because so much of what people think of as happiness has to do with the excitation of pleasurable feeling. And because so often that ends up in some state of misery or other, you know, following down that track, you know, you have to be so very careful. There's the right use of the feelings, and there's a way to try to stimulate feeling that can be very, unhelpful and spiritually unhealthy. As an important aspect of this, just being very careful about getting excited, in that line, I can't help thinking of the advice, the single piece of advice that River Master gave me all the time that I was training with her and getting, over the years so much good advice. The single piece of advice that helped me most was just the simple words, just don't worry about external things. And it's applying that particular teaching in absolutely relentless details is what led to my Kensho in 1977. I just needed a lifeline to hang on to, and that was it. And I just, whenever I start to come out of meditation, come out of a meditative attitude and start to get wrapped up in the things that, in the fears that I was so beset by at the time, I'd draw back into myself and get centered again, remembering this is, this is external things. Don't worry about external things. It's not the same as saying, don't actually attend to anything. Don't do anything useful in life. Don't do anything that needs to be done. It's not the same at all. You can, all that time I was doing my job in the monastery, in those couple months that between her giving me that advice and my popping, so to speak. I was doing my job. I was going to the meditation hall. I was doing my training. Really working at not worrying about external things didn't stop me attending to what really needed to be done. It particularly helped me stop worrying about what other people might think of me, what might become of people I loved, and what might become of me in the future. It helped just provide some distance from these dreads and fears and hopes, and that as you pursue them in your mind, you blind yourself to the truth that's right under your feet, supporting you. That's right in the breath that you're breathing. And so this, applying that advice very thoroughly, put a bung in a place where my hole, so to speak, my spiritual hole was leaking seriously. And when it did that, it enabled the water of the Spirit to move up rather than to get scattered outwards. And so not surprisingly, as soon as I started to apply that, within a very short time, I started to have these waves of profound gratitude and also at the same time often grief. I would, I would stand there in morning service every morning, and I would, as soon as morning service started, I would cry. And I would cry through the whole of morning service so that I had a handkerchief, it was soaked, the front of my kesa was wet, the front of my robe was wet, just sitting there with the tears rolling down my cheeks, and at the same time experiencing not just the grief, but this deep gratitude welling up. What is it that was happening there? Well, it's just that where I was leaking and externalizing everything into external things and getting caught in my doubts and my fears and my worries, I was driving a bung in it. In the place where it was leaking from. And that meant that the stuff that was seething in me couldn't just leak outwards, it had to go up. And it did. And when that happens really, you know, at a profound level, it is a great rush up the back of the water of the Spirit. Which is what that led to. This is, by the way, the source of the kind of 90 to 100 day training term. That's about how long it takes to cook that, to do that kind of cooking. Now, you know, people, especially people who did psychology, you know, would say, well, you know, weren't you repressing? You're just repressing something. No, the answer was I wasn't repressing anything. I was actually just stopping doing something that was harmful to myself. I was stopping the misuse of the will, and I was applying it to a rightful use of the will, a helpful use of the will. I wasn't actually repressing anything. But it was the intensity of my training at that time was, the whole monastery knew it. You know, I know that Rimasa was just, I mean, she was just watching. It was very clear to her after a very short time, I'm sure, where it was headed. And, you know, she'd had to do a couple things to really kind of help me get on the right track. Because first I went to kind of the gateway into that level of training. And it first kind of sank in a kind of a despair, and then I tried to storm heaven. You know, they turned the will the other way and tried to grab at enlightenment. And River Master, you know, helped me with both aspects of that. When I was trying too hard, she said, "Well, friend, you know, you see your good intentions, but you need to just, you know, go about your daily life in the monastery and trust." So she helped me get more of a middle path training, and then it was just up to me. And then, you know, I was no longer in an excited, agitated state. I was in a very intense state, but the intensity was just the result of cooking so much stuff. You know, sometimes it's just intense because there's a lot going on inside you. But it was no longer being just whipped around by external circumstances, by my involvement in external circumstances. So when I think of not getting wound up emotionally, to me, this particular time in my life is a very good example of how, you know, when, you know, feelings were running very strong at times, but my with my teacher's help, You know, the effort, my effort of training kind of was able to meet the degree of my effort of training was able to meet the degree of intensity of feeling. It's, you know, basically the spiritual stuff cooking in me at the time. And anyone who's able to go through that process is, in my mind, a very fortunate person, even though, you know, you don't wish such a depth of suffering as I was doing at the time on anyone. But once I actually got on to how to use the will right and how to apply the meditation that I've been doing now for about 3 years at the time, I've been a monk about 3 years when I went into this, and we've been doing a lot of meditation, and so you know, I knew what, you know, how to do it. Once I got helped finding the kind of middle path of the how to use the effort in the right way, not to strive for a result, I got to where I start to go the least little distance down striving for a result, and something had just drop, like this door would just drop down. I tried it really good for a few days, and it made me so miserable and so deluded. But you know, I got a good dose of what, you know, trying to storm heaven does to you, and how unhelpful it is. I also had such a good dose of what it is to just wallow in despair. It's all a period of just, you know, just a few weeks there. You know, you know, talk about swinging between the opposites. Well, of course, I was just a kid. I was just 27. But in my mind, you know, I was very fortunate. And you know, very fortunate to have a teacher who was able to help provide the direction at the time. And it was really clear no one was going to be able to do the work but me. So when the external things are seeming so pressing and important that, you know, that involvement in them becomes a justification for simply really losing your center, just remember that you're chasing unrealities at that point. And there's nothing that is that important. There's nothing that's important.